Something else is hurting you. That's why you need pot, or whiskey, or whips and rubber suits. Or screaming music turned so loud you can't think. Charles Bukowski, as quoted in Tales of Ordinary Madness. Solve the World, a fictional adventure told in 100 episodes. Episode 88. Poof! I'm not doing it! How many ways do I have to say it? Are you listening to me at all? Snot ran down Petra's nose, slopping ineloquently into her gaping mouth. When in conflict, the boyfriend and girlfriend pair often made room for shouting. This, though, Nate could finally see, this was different. Petra was at the brink of something. Fear? Was it that? The two of them hid out together during the plague. Nate stood beside Petra when she found her family dead in their living room. She wept, she cried herself to sleep. That was then, and that was that. But even that, that wasn't like this.
Can you give me one reason? Just one reason! Just one good, decent reason for wanting to do this!
Was this Petra? Was this that jolly, bouncy, bubbly girl that Nate had once upon a time believed he had fallen in love with? Was this the same girl? Or had someone replaced her? Replaced her with whatever this manic, screaming witch was?
Answer me, Nate! Answer me right now! Are you seeing Jenna? Is that what this insomnia is all about? Don't you shh me! Answer me! Right now! Or I'm gone!
Just take your Balaam.
No!
Trust me, this'll go easier if you do. Those were the wrong words. Nate felt the impact immediately. Regret wasted no time on arrival. Petra fell into a puddle, sobbing profusely. From her lap, she tried to bellow out some twisted question or blather out some vitriol. Whatever it was, Nate couldn't make heads or tails of it. I can't go on like this. He managed to begin. It wasn't the right beginning, not a good way to commence at all. He was still giving her the wrong impression. But at least he was in the gate now.
Just be a man and leave!
Petra launched. No, just give me a minute to explain. Strike two.
I don't want to hear your piss-poor excuses. I knew I never liked her.
Just shut up for a minute, okay? Telling your weeping girl to shut up? That was definitely strike three. But she was too much of a mess to do anything, but Sid collapsed in her own little puddle, so Nate's had time to explain. Right now. If he could just get it out. Whatever it was. S refuses to see self-contradiction. Three sessions in a row. Three separate techniques. Three separate angles. Appears to be utterly unaware of his hypocrisy. When faced with it, assesses blame elsewhere. For next session, attempt wounded healer perspective. Share imaginary backstory to gain trust. Prove to him that you're wounded, and he'll begin to hatch from his safety shell. Watch. Make your story something that shines. He has to completely buy into it. Take him on the journey. Show him your scars. Exploit a real experience if that makes it easier, but be sure to embiggen it. Make him believe, 100%, that whatever he's going through, you went through it worse, and you messed up harder.
Lenore Kotnik types these words at her workstation cubby in her high-rise apartment when her locked door suddenly opens. A figure, veiled in shadow, looms in. Lenore Kotnik? The shrink grabs at her right wrist. It shakes uncontrollably when she's nervous. Her nerves get to her. Firmly held down, the wrist now out of commission, her voice becomes flat, cool, steady. I did what you asked. Tell me about it. It went just as I predicted it would. She was shaken when she came in. I ran her through the dissociative disorder diagnostic, using only the questions we knew would trip her up. And she left. Where did she go? That wasn't my job. I thought you were tailing her. I'm going to need your computer. Mr. Smith floats across the room. This is good. A better lead than he'd expected. Why? Lenore rises from her seat, intent on flipping the lights on. Don't do that. Why? Who are you? What we need to discern today is not who I am, but who you thought I was. We find Jenna Finn laying under a tree. She's staring up at the branches, the leaves shimmering amidst ripples of cool breeze. What do I want? Our high-as-a-kite protagonist asked herself. What do I want? The answer was simple. Peace on Earth. Peace on Earth. She said aloud to herself. That's what I want. The opposite of Miles. He is peaceless. I want the opposite. She imagined him, transformed by peace, standing, dressed in royal robes, smiling, clean-shaven, wide-eyed, and content. The face of the version of Miles that she last encountered bore no resemblance to Jenna's imaginary mirage now. What's keeping me from peace? The question swirled around in Jenna's thoughts, until it actualized, like a feather in the wind. It swiveled in circles in the breeze just above her head, slowly, methodically, but freely spinning upwards, following the base of the tree north towards the day sky. Up, up, up and around, up and around. She lost its essence somewhere between the branches and the leaves. Trees. 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 Look at this one. Is it like that other? The one that makes the balaam? The balaam I ingest? The balaam that gets me get through this day? The balaam that's getting me towards peace? Not all the way there, but closer. Closer. Peace inside. That's progress, old girl. More so than the revelation of 100 demons, jackals, and minotaurs. This. Peace. Trees. In Japan. That's where the balaam comes from. What's the deal with trees, anyway? Somewhere, somewhere, Jenna had heard, I mean, like, really heard, like, deeply, about this tree that was the root of all life. Some myth, some legend. What culture? What century? Hard to say. Useless to know. Trees. Trees. They stretch out, up and down. They stretch, and they hold. That's what makes them so special. So, so special. They grow, but you can't watch them grow. They live, but they don't speak. They're alive, but they bend in with the background. How magical. How wonderful. How peaceful. With this, Jenna Finn felt something akin to the munchies. But this was the munchies of knowledge. Trees were the answer. She needed intel. She got up and walked to the closest store that sold information. That store just so happened to be an old pawn shop. There's a funny scene to capture there between Jenna and the kooky Christopher Walken-esque pawn shop owner. But surely you feel it now. There's not much time left. It's said that things happen in threes. For the world, there's just been a nuclear holocaust and an earthwide pandemic. One, two. The third card's about to be played. Three. Very soon now. The card, the final one in the deck, will first fall while Jenna Finn is utterly intoxicated, fully functioning under the drug's influence. She's an addict now, and Balaam is her mistress. As Petra told her, Balaam comes from a grove of trees in Japan. The word Balaam, however, is an ancient one, whose origins boast not the Far East as its homeland, but Mesopotamia. Balaam was a wizard, an ancient world wizard, renowned enough throughout the world that more than one culture wrote of his deeds. This is true. The Jews captured his likeness in the Torah, the Book of Numbers, which happens to be the fourth book of the Old Testament of the Bible. But Balaam was not a Jew. He was something else. He was a mystery man. Still, the Book of Numbers relates a story about the wizard of old lore. He is commissioned by a king to perform a hex, a curse. Balaam wants his reward, so he is eager to perform the ritual. But every time he tries to curse, poof, he blesses. Just like that. His curses come out as blessings. The lesson of the parable is simple. The magician is not the master of the magic. It was, in Balaam's case, and the case of all wizards and warlocks, that it is the magic itself that is doing the leading. That is the master. The Balaams of this world are merely puppets. Jenna walked out of the old pawn shop with two items, a videotape and a VCR to play said tape. She was quite excited. The VCR would serve as the perfect splash of Art Deco for her newly purchased sailboat. The videotape would give her something to do on long nights at sea. She had hoped to find a book about trees, but the pawn dealer had nothing of the sort. All he had was part one of some old college lecture series captured on video cassette. This particular tape was entitled The Tree and the Resurrection, From Yggdrasil to Ragnarok. It was then that Jen realized why she had bought the sailboat. It wasn't just to escape her dog murderer. It was to go somewhere. To go back in time. To go to the original tree. To go to Eden. Jen had found Eden once. She and Alexandra Keitel. Together. They had just escaped Hades, aka Pishtaco's Island, and found a serene place, another island, where a man could talk to God. Jenna Finn was going to Eden, to Aaron Amaru and his family, and she was going to invite Nates and Petra along for the ride. It was, in fact, this proposition that Nates and Petra found themselves arguing about so heatedly. "I'm dying," Nate said.
"What?"
"Well, not really. I don't have a disease or anything."
"Then..."
"It's like this stuff... inside." Nate made a welling up motion with his arms around his stomach.
"Stuff?"
Petra questioned politely.
"Yeah, I got this stuff. In my insides."
"Stuff?"
"Yeah, that's about it. Stuff."
"Is that why you can't sleep?"
"Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's why I can't sleep."
"Okay, good conversation. Glad we got that straightened up. You're leaving me for Jenna because you have stuff inside."
No, I'm not. I'm not doing that."
"But you're in love with her, aren't you?"
"It's not like that. I don't know if I love anyone. That's the problem. Again, not an answer an irate girlfriend wants to hear. Nate's never had a way with comforting words. I guess you could call it depression." That changed Petra's countenance at once. I don't know what I'm living for. And, you do that long enough, not know what you're doing, and, it gets to you."
"Are you suicidal?"
"No. I mean, I don't think about killing myself."
"But you're dying?"
"Yeah, I think so."
"How?"
"I don't know. I'm starting to believe that unless I change something, like soon, rapidly, immediately, unless I do something, I'm just going to close my eyes and poof.
Poof?
Yeah, poof.
Poof?
Poof!
What is poof?
Poof is, fade away.
Die.
Nate was stoic in his consideration of this definition. Then, a slow, affirming head nod. I guess so.
So, you want to go, just for the sake of change?
I've been waiting for something to happen. Anything. And now it has. We have this opportunity.
What do you mean, something to happen? Have you looked around recently? There's always things happening. This has been the most happening time in the history of time.
Something to me, Petra. I've been waiting for something to happen to me.
Okay. So, just help me see this one more time. Tell me, why do you have to go with Jenna on that boat to the other side of the world?
Us. I want us to go on that boat.
Okay. Why do we have to go with Jenna?
Because if we don't, I think I'm gonna die.
That's it. That's all you got.
Nate smiled. Did you hear the joke about the man and the magic fish?
No.
It goes like this. A man catches a magic fish. The fish says to the man, he says, "Man, if you spare my life, I'll give you 3 wishes." The man considers this and says, "But what I really want is to eat magic fish for dinner." The fish falls on his flippers and pleads for his life, saying, this is what he says. He says, "Come on, man. There must be something you want. I'm a magic fish. I can do anything. Anything in the whole world. Anything you want." The man considers this and then says, "Okay, fish, are you really super serious? Anything in the world?" "Yup," says the fish. "And you'll give me 3 wishes?" "Sure will." "All right, I got it. For my first wish, I want you to put all the Chinese people in Japan." "Japan's gonna get very crowded," says the magic fish. "Yes, sir, sure will." And then the fish says, "Well, okay then." And he flaps his flippers together, then says, "Voila, done. All the Chinese are in Japan." "Great," says the man. "Good job, magic fish."
"Nate, come on.
Just listen, okay? Just listen. Are you ready for your second wish?" says the magic fish. The man says, "Sure am." The fish says, "Okay, what's your second wish?" The man says, "Magic fish, please move all the Japanese people to China." The fish flaps his fins together, does a little twirl, and says, "Voila, it's done." "Great," says the man. "And your last wish, are you ready for it?" says the magic fish. That's what he says. And then the man says, "Sure am, fishy. For my last wish, please take all the Chinese people and put them back in China, and take all the Japanese folks and put them back in Japan." The fish smiles and says, "Your wish is my command. Voila, it's done." Being a good noble man, the man lets go of the fish, and the fish swims off a little ways. But at the last moment, the fish turns around, risking getting caught again, and he sticks out his big mouth out of the water and turns to the man and says, "Hey, mister, why did you wish for those dumb wishes?" The man shrugs and says, this is what he says. He says, "For the action!" When Jenna returned to Nate's and Petra, the couple agreed to sail to the South Pacific with Jenna on her newly purchased sailboat. Petra then asked Jenna when she planned to leave. Jenna said the day after tomorrow. There was one last thing she had to do. There was a U Club meeting the next day, and Miss Finn herself was scheduled to speak. She wasn't going to miss it. Katya's story.
When you were little, you used to think about the past, the way back past. You imagined yourself as a princess in the high tower above some hidden forest where fairies and their tales were still accepted as logical.
Or you'd be Cleopatra, the most beautiful, charming, powerful ruler in all the world. Or, if you were really in the mood, you'd hop out of the shower, naked, 9 years old maybe, imagining you were Eve in the first garden without a care in the world. You'd bounce around pretending the bookshelf was a tree, each book a sweet nectarine or strawberry. The footrest is a kind of zebra, the lamp a patient giraffe that you ride around the long garden on. Whenever you imagined living a happy or extraordinary life, you always went back in time. This persisted even as you grew older. That's why you studied Latin and ancient manuscripts in college. Going back in time served as a wonderful getaway, a form of escapism, but a true escapism, not one of those nerdy Dungeons and Dragons escapisms. No, there were really medieval times. There were real princesses, and Cleopatra was a real badass lady. Mother never liked you playing these games. She was an interesting woman, a genius, really. Sad to say, your family line is full of geniuses. But for whatever reason, the genius gene didn't hit you. They say stuff like that sometimes skips a generation. Well, folks, you're looking at a generation skip right here. Grandpa was a surgeon. Grandma was a nurse, but could easily have been a doctor. In fact, she often ordered prescriptions, got exams done, pretty much did everything a doctor does, and then would just go and get the attending in charge to sign his name. The attending saved time, and Grandma got to do what she loved to do in a rather misogynistic, sexist society. All that medical prowess passed down to Mother. She worked in biochemicals. She spent most of her adult life working on creating antidepressants. She struggled herself with depression her whole life. In the end, it swallowed her up. You guess that's the one genetic push in your favor. Genius seems to always have the specter of depression hovering in its shadow. Yours truly doesn't have to worry about that. You've never truly been depressed, not like your mother or uncle, a day in your life. The thing about practicing medicine, especially back when your grandparents were in their heyday, is that the best doctors are as much artists and explorers as they are medical bookworms, rote memory statisticians. Medicine is an art. That's why doctors practice it. Curing people takes practice. My mother understood this, but her gene pool didn't allow for her to feel this. She was a twin. You wonder if your mother and her twin brother both got half of the genes they were supposed to. Mother was all memory, all logic, all textbook. That's why she didn't like you playing pretend, particularly playing pretend past. She'd tell you, the past wasn't any better or worse than life now. For a long time, you thought that was ridiculous. After all, we have painkillers, automatic washing machines, flying people carriers, wireless internet. How does that not make life better? Although you always liked to play past, you intuitively believed what most everyone else knows. Our tools make life better. The theory of evolution reinforces this idea, right? Life is better now than it was, and it should be better, and it should be better still in 1,000 years than it is today. But this is where Mother would wring her hands. She'd answer quickly to that. She'd say, inflation doesn't change the bottom line. More on that in a sec. You need to talk about your uncle, Mother's twin. You see, he's the one that got Grandpa's artistic brain. Up until his divorce, your uncle worked in computer coding, specifically in video games and virtual reality. When the divorce came, and his two kids were taken away from him, first thing he did was quit his job. He had a history of alcoholism, so everyone was naturally worried. The general fear was that he quit his job so that he could drink himself to death. Right? That's something that a genius would do. But that's not what happened. He used his coding genius, his artistic prowess, to escape this world. He'd hate that you just called it that. He'd say it was the opposite of escapism, actually. It was leaning into the very essence of life. You see, he created rooms. Virtual rooms. That was his word for it. Rooms. Though, they were more like worlds than anything that looked like a room. Realms, maybe. On day one, the rooms were barren. 6 barren rooms. In each room, he created a sort of AI being. Not true beings, mind you, but mapped out computer programs. For all intents and purposes, though, these things were real. They looked kind of like 3-dimensional stick figures when they were first born. Each one of the 6 was born into a blank, gray tundra, their room. The being, or the beings, or the programs, thoughts, filled out the room. Filled out their universe. The program learned in this way. Whatever it thought, whatever circuits it ran, became something physical in the room. And here's the kicker. Uncle brands each of the six beings, the six three-dimensional programs, with a single emotion. So, there's joy, peace, pride, confusion, hate, and anger. Your uncle's thought was simple. He'd spend the rest of his days walking from room to room, watching these programs unspool themselves. His problem, the thing he wanted to overcome, was that he had these feelings inside him. Rejection, betrayal, hurt. And they just sat there, in his body, in his mind, his heart, his soul. But they never went anywhere. They just swirled around on endless loops in his mind. It was driving him mad. So he constructed the rooms to exist so that the emotions went somewhere. They evolved. With his six beings, he could observe the real evolution of emotion over time. You know what happened, though, at first? It didn't work. The programs all did one thing, over and over and over again. Joy jumped up and down, endlessly. Up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. And yes, because of the way the room worked, every time he jumped, or it jumped, he went higher up, and every time he hit the ground gave way. In this way, then, the jumping was like digging a tunnel. The impact of each jump pushing the virtual ground down, digging a hole. Anger, in his rage, physically tore at the dirt in his room. He never stopped. He dug and 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 dug. Peace, being always content, merely sat. If left forever, the ground below would slowly wear away. All six beings, six different emotions, led to the same room reality. Holes. Holes in the ground. Uncle tried again. He tweaked the program, ever so slightly. He added to each of hate, anger, joy, confusion, peace, and pride, a dash of hope. That was the magic bullet. With hope, joy made marvelous things. Blooming trees, endlessly tall waterfalls and rainbows, green grass and purple vines beside yellow brick roads leading into happy, smiling clouds. Peace created bubbles that she floated around in. She learned to levitate and focused on the geometry of circles and spheres. Confusion painted his room dashes of contrasting colors. He built M.C. Escher staircases that twisted the principles of logic. He stretched his face to unfamiliar proportions like Edward Munch's The Scream. Hate cluttered her room with words that had weight. They fell down like sledgehammers when spoken. Anger built himself up like a warrior, then tore his flesh in defiance. He built pyramids and worshipped gods of blood. Pride made peasants to serve him. He bounded their hands behind their backs and made his own arms longer than a monkey's. He swung from massive redwood to long palm tree, beating his chest and causing his peasants to fall on their knees in humility and fear. All this, Uncle watched. While he watched them, you watched him. His hair fell out. He stopped eating. So entranced by his creation. Eventually, he died in the rooms, watching his creation flourish. Uncle created worlds, but he could still never transcend his earthly situation. The pain of his divorce, the shock of losing his children. Even as he became a god, he still was stuck here on this finite ground. Mother always said, inflation doesn't change the bottom line. You know what that means now. Today, yesterday, 10,000 years ago, 20 million years in the future, it doesn't much matter. You still want the same things. Maybe you think the answer is to find a lover. Go, get one. Then you'll want two. Want a new phone? Go, get one. You'll need the next generation in a month. Our system is built on hope, and hope can never be fed. You can try to give it milk to drink. Sure, it'll lap it up. Guzzle it down, even. Nurse and devour whatever you offer. But in the end, it'll just want it twice as much. More and 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 more. That's the human experience. Whether you live in a cave or a 21st century mansion with 10,000 slaves at your beck and call, the bottom line's the same. Mother knew the answer. She was a biochemist. You see, she knew that all we ever want is dopamine and serotonin. The only two things our bodies really crave. Inflation doesn't change the bottom line. Thank you.
You're not with either of them, are you? Lenore Kotnik stated flatly. Unamused by her poor fortune, she had now been held hostage by three separate parties, each wanting their hands on this Jenna Finn, each with different motives. She could be dead soon. Any one of the three could kill her. This man might do so right now. She had to act cool. Play it cool, all right. I need to know who they are. I don't know. They didn't give names. Who do they work for? I don't know. How did they contact you? If you say I don't know, tomorrow you'll find that your bank account is drained and your credit gone. The first one was just like you. Came in the middle of the night. Man or woman? Man. Armed? Yes. What sort of gun? I don't know. No more I don't knows. That one cost you $2,000. Now, while there's still money left in your account, describe the gun to me.
A handgun, but long. I think it's called a silencer.
Good. Tell me about the other one.
She came in the next morning.
She?
Yes. She had made an appointment, a new patient.
What did she look like?
Pretty, well-dressed, maybe mid-20s.
What did she want?
She wanted me... two things. The first... She wanted me to... contact the first person.
How did she know about the first person? You told her?
No, she came in. Knowing about her.
How did you get in contact with the first person?
I don't know.
That was a lie. And a stupid one at that. Smith knew what to do. He took her computer, got the manifest of her patient list, found several suitable pinch points. Doctors, medical or psychological, made for easy targets. There was always someone along the line who could be seduced into screwing them over. Lawsuits are easy to procure. Sometimes it's the loner that's hardest to pinch. The more tentacles you have in society, the easier you are to nab. And Dr. Lenore Kotnik had many tentacles. Ultimately, though, the information Lenore Kotnik provided to Mr. Smith and the gurus at New Washington was close to useless. But this much was now known. Someone else had found Jennifer Dash. But there was internal bickering as to what to do with her. That was the only thing keeping Miss Dash autonomous. And alive. Internal bickering. Spencer.
Yes, Mr. Smith?
I need a boat. And poof. Just like that, he had one.
Hey, hey, hey! Solve the World is produced by myself, Dante Stack. Full attribution for the sound effects and music we use on this show from week to week can be found on my show notes page at DanteStack.com. Guys, I say this every week, but I'm going to keep battering this drum until you all listen and do as I say. We need to multiply our numbers. Like us on Facebook. Facebook.com/SolveTheWorldPodcast. And while you're on Facebook, share our page with others and help me grow this audience. We got a great story running here, guys, and I'm hoping to grow our audience so I can sustain the pace of producing an episode week to week. And I need your help to accomplish that. All right. Thanks for listening.
See you next time.